Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Preisman, and we've got a really fun one for you today. Michael Shulman is a writer living in New York City. His first book, Her Again, Becoming Meryl Streep, about the actress's artistic coming of age in the 70s, was a New York Times bestseller. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and his new book is called Oscar Wars, A History of Hollywood in Gold, Sweat, and Tears. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, Maris.
Oh my gosh, there's so much to discuss. I think where I want to start is I'm getting the impression, Michael, that perhaps the Academy Awards are not based on merit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Ask Andrea Riseborough.
Amazing. I didn't realize, I guess, until I read the book, how much it really does kind of resemble politics in the way that voting happens, that campaigning happens.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, like presidential campaign, there's a whole cottage industry of strategists and publicists and people running campaigns basically year-round. And to draw up the metaphor, in presidential campaigns, you have the caucuses and the primaries, and in the Oscars, you have the Toronto Film Festival and the BAFTAs and the Golden Globes. The Golden Globes are like Super Tuesday, I guess. You know, and then in politics, you have like candidates going to like the county fair in Iowa, I guess not no longer Iowa, but New Hampshire or South Carolina, and, you know, having to talk with voters. And in the Oscar race, they go to the Santa Barbara Film Festival and receive an honorary award, or they go to a screening in New York City and go to a cocktail party and sit on a panel and answer questions. So there are just a ton of factors that go into what gets attention and what gets into the quote unquote conversation. And it means that, you know, a lot of great movies get left out of the conversation. What's amazing about this Andrea Riseborough thing is that it kind of short-circuited that whole system. And
yeah,
you saw that one actress with a few really well-placed, influential A-list friends was able to sort of circumvent that all. And I don't know if there's like a political, like who's a candidate who just kind of used social media and came out of nowhere. It would be like that. Imagine if like a presidential candidate just didn't have any money and just used like, just had like a bunch of really cool friends who just Instagrammed on their behalf. And then they became like a presidential candidate.
Incredible. And I also, I think I like kind of understood this, but not until I read your book did I realize that the Academy was founded partially as a way for producers to come together and be anti-labor.
Yes. Yes. This is the anti-labor secret history of the Academy. I mean, it's not that secret, but basically the Academy was formed in 1927 by these 36 founding members who were a cross-section of the powerful, most powerful people in silent era Hollywood. It was the brainchild of Louis B. Mayer, who was the head of MGM, a very powerful man. And their early rhetoric had so much, it was very sort of utopian and high flown. It was all about how they were going to create harmony in the industry and like lift up the art form of motion pictures, which all sounds really great. And they sort of, and they were believers in those things, but there were some undercurrents beneath that that are a little more cynical. One of them was that there were signs that the actors, writers and directors might start forming unions. And that was a direct threat to people like Louis B. Mayer. And so the harmony that they spoke of took the form of the Academy like resolving labor disputes and negotiating contracts. And so keeping everyone happy with this system that was fundamentally very tilted and exploitative. And it kind of worked because they sort of held off Actors Equity, which was trying to come in from New York, and Actors Equity was for stage actors on Broadway, but they were sort of making inroads to Hollywood. The Academy basically displaced them for 5 years until SAG was formed during the Depression. And then SAG sort of went to war with the Academy. And then the other kind of underlying thing that was happening was this huge PR problem for Hollywood, this huge image problem, because in the 20s, there were all these salacious scandals, one after the other, like the trials of Fatty Arbuckle and the murder of William Desmond Taylor and all these things. And so then as now, there was a culture war in the country, and there was a conservative religious element in the country that had been really behind prohibition, and they decided that the movies were now the big corrupting evil in America. And they were pushing for censorship. They saw Hollywood as this cesspool of sin. You know, this is why the production code was created, the Hays Office, to sort of like self-censor and put a good spin on things and make sure that there was no sin in the movies, regardless of what was happening in behind the scenes. And so the Academy kind of rebranded the whole industry and made it seem like a much more lofty endeavor.
So noble. And then, of course, I love that almost immediately the talkies come and all of a sudden the sound guys are demanding rights and care pay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, so what was so interesting about year one, like I have 11 chapters in the book that each go into a single year or a single sort of category even that was like juicy and tell some larger story of cultural change in movies or in American life or in the Oscars. And year one was on like incredible shifting ground. It was like a moment. It was the awards took 2 years for the Academy to actually get around to. It was, they were kind of an afterthought at first, but they finally had their first awards in 1929. And it was a moment of complete upheaval in the industry because the talkies had arrived and the balance of power was shifting. All these actors were getting sort of thrown out of the industry or because they had the wrong voices and new people were coming in. And it was just very destabilizing. And as anyone who has seen Singing in the Rain knows, or probably fewer people, Babylon. But anyway, so the first awards, they had to give the jazz singer, the seminal talkie, a special honorary award because it couldn't even compete with the nominees, which were all silent movies. It like didn't even belong in the same category of thing. And then by the next year, all of the nominees had sound. So it was just this. Also, year one, it was the first and only year they had an award for best title writing, meaning like the intertitles in in a silent picture. So this guy, Joseph Farnham, has the distinction of being the only winner of best title writing.
Love that. And it's kind of incredible looking at Hollywood now. Like, yes, there are cyclical problems that you revisit over and over again in this book, but Hollywood is so unionized, at least, and the Academy seems to be fairly powerful still. How did that happen?
Well, basically, in the 1930s, these guilds became very powerful very quickly. This was the labor movement of the 30s, which the whole country was wrapped up in during the Depression and under FDR. And so SAG formed and the Screen Directors Guild, the Screen Writers Guild, they all came together fairly rapidly in the 30s. And they hated the Academy because the Academy, they thought, was the company union. It was like this fake way of just sort of undermining them and giving the appearance of negotiation and fairness, but it was really just run by the producers. They weren't wrong about that, but it really got ugly. And these guilds would direct their members to resign en masse from the Academy. And then they would even go as far as boycotting the Oscars. And so it became this all out, it's either you or us. And the reason why that war ended is because Frank Capra was the director of the president of the Academy, of course, the famous director. And he loved the Academy. He loved the Oscars. He loved winning Oscars. He was a real fan of the whole thing. And he realized that if the Academy kept on trying to be the labor mediator in Hollywood, it would be the death of this organization. So he just decided we won't do that anymore. And so by the end of the 30s, the Academy had just stopped doing anything related to labor or negotiating or anything economic in the industry. And they kept the Oscars, which were the only thing they did that everyone seemed to like.
Yeah. And you mentioned Frank Capra, and I was fascinated by your portrayal of him. I think it's one of the themes in the book, it seems, is the idea of who is establishment is always changing. New people come in and then they sort of age into their
right. Like people start as upstarts and then they end as the establishment who's sort of defending their turf. And that happens with a couple people in the book, like Steven Spielberg is in the 70s chapter as the director of Jaws in his 20s. And then by the 90s chapter, he's like the heavyweight who's has Saving Private Ryan. And he's sort of under assault by these the forces of Weinstein. But yeah, I mean, Frank Capra, he came to America as an immigrant from Italy, totally impoverished, kind of pulled himself up and became a hit director. I mean, a lot of this is sort of in his autobiography, the name above the title, he sort of tells his life story as if it's a Frank Capra movie. Like you feel like you're watching, you know, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town or It's a Wonderful Life. Everything is a little snappy and a little like feel good. And so I found it really interesting to just sort of look at how he saw himself. And he wanted that Oscar so badly because he realized that the Academy was the Brahmins, as he put it, of Hollywood. And he was this Italian immigrant, come from nothing guy who wanted to infiltrate the establishment and become it. And he wound up not only winning a bunch of Oscars in the 30s, but becoming the Academy, becoming the leadership of it, almost like single-handedly, just him.
Yeah, that, incredible. And then you also talk about all of the young and exciting filmmakers of the 60s, 70s, who in recent years, when Academy membership has changed, have become the old fuddy-duddies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the birth of the new Hollywood is a big phase in the sort of era in the late 60s through the mid 70s-ish, when you had like the rise of Scorsese and Coppola and Altman and all these people, these very rambunctious auteur directors who came around in a moment when the studios sort of didn't know how to talk to young people. The generation gap of the late 60s was a very wide gap. And so these filmmakers basically had a lot of control. They had a lot of power because the studios were a bit at a loss, and they it was this famous sort of moment of revolution in film, and you get amazing movies out of that, like Midnight Cowboy and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But then it's so interesting to sort of see the wheel turn, and in the Oscar So White era, you have that sort of generation now older and established and sort of feeling very aggrieved by the idea of diversifying the Academy membership. Not all of them, obviously, but you know, it was a generational war once again, and they were on the other side of it.
I was fascinated to learn about the role that Candace Bergen played in getting out, the recruiting some of the youngsters in the 60s. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I love Candace Bergen. She's amazing. I mean, so I grew up with her on Murphy Brown, and only learned a little bit later in life that she had been this starlet and sort of it girl in like the late 60s, early 70s. And of course she did all these great movies like Carnal Knowledge. But anyway, I, at some point, found this correspondence in Gregory Peck's files at the Academy Library.
Incredible.
And basically, the 22 or 3-year-old Candace Bergen in 1969 was writing to Gregory Peck, who was the president of the Academy, telling him that the Academy is basically full of antiquities who are gumming up the works, and you need to reach out to some hip young people like my friends. And her friends were like Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda, like the guys who made Easy Rider. Like, she was perfectly positioned to be this bridge because she was a Nepo baby, as we'd say now. She was
indeed,
you know, she was a child of Hollywood. Her father was the famous ventriloquist Edgar Bergen, but she was this, she had this sort of, she was young and she was sort of had this, this inroad with the counterculture people. And she realized that none of those people cared about the Academy Awards, and they weren't reflected and they weren't in the Academy. So she wrote to Gregory Peck and said, can I go and recruit some of my friends? And he said, yeah, please do it. And you just see their sort of, they didn't really know each other very well. They sort of knew each other as acquaintances, but you see in these letters, just like these two opposite sides of this cultural divide and generational divide kind of like collaborating together on how to make the Academy less out of date.
You mentioned Gregory Peck's files. I mean, tell me a little bit about the research required in putting this book together, because I imagine it's some original reporting. It's a lot of looking in archives. It's a lot of books that you've had to read.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, it took me 4 years, which I was a little over a year late with it, in part because I have my day job at The New Yorker, which keeps me very busy. So it was a long process. And the concept of the book was to, again, just like have these like episodic chapters where it wasn't every year of the Oscars, but I just chose like a dozen or so and went deep into them. But I quickly realized that I had, in order to tell those stories, I had to feed my brain with everything I could about each era and had to learn a lot. So in terms of research, it was so different one era to the next, because of course, if you're doing 1929 or 42, everyone's dead. And that involved a lot of reading books and biographies and going to the Academy Library and the Library of Performing Arts in New York and going through archives. And that was really fun. I loved doing that. And then sort of as the chronology got later, more people were alive. At first, maybe it was someone's offspring, like Judy Holliday's son I interviewed, or mm-hmm. Dalton Trumbo's daughter, Gregory Peck's sons. And then by the end of the book, you know, it's about 2017 and everyone's around and everyone's working in Hollywood still. And it's sort of like reporting a magazine piece that is about the industry today. So yeah, it's shifted. I actually wrote the chapters out of order. So it's kind of just to keep myself on my toes. I didn't write it chronologically. I would skip around and do like a more modern chapter and then go back to an older era and then go back to more modern and then kind of put them all in order for the book.
I love that. And it gives me license then to skip to 1989, because I want to hear you talk about Alan Carr, who I knew very little about, and exactly what he did for the Oscars, which seems kind of legendary.
Yeah. Okay. This was probably the most fun chapter to work on. It's about the 1989 ceremony, which is notorious, usually referred to as the worst Oscars ever, mostly because it opened with this gigantic 11-minute like splashy production number that included notoriously Rob Lowe singing Proud Mary with a woman dressed as Snow White in a replica of the Coconut Grove with dancing cocktail tables. Like, it's just completely campy and over the top and insane. And I think really fun, but at the time it was just derided. And the man behind all of this was Alan Carr, who was known at the time for a few things. One is being the producer of Grease. Another is he produced La Cage aux Folles on Broadway, but he'd also had some misfires like Can't Stop the Music, the movie of the Village People. And he was also known for being very flamboyant, which is how they wink, wink that people were gay at the time. He was like flamboyantly gay, wore incredible caftans and threw these like wild parties at his house. But he wanted his whole life to produce the Oscars. And when he finally got the chance, he put his name absolutely everywhere. Everyone knew these were the Alan Carr Oscars, and he was making these big promises. It's going to be bigger, glitzier, better, more glamorous, blah, 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 blah. And then when it was so schlocky, everyone knew where to point the finger. And so it really became this Icarus story of like this guy who flew too close to the Oscar sun, and it wound up really ruining his career and his life. It was a devastating blow to him. And in the end, I found this story to be kind of a tragedy. As like campy and crazy as it is in the details, there was also something at its heart really sad about it, because it was about someone who wanted something so badly and then just became ostracized when it didn't go well.
And yet it seems like he has allowed for many careers to flourish at like E! Doing red carpet reports.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the things that he did contribute was beefing up the red carpet and the fashion for the show. And the red carpet had not been such a thing. There was usually in old Academy Awards, you see like there's 5 minutes of footage at the beginning of people coming, arriving. And they say, there's Goldie Hawn, the star of blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Carr realized that it could be more of a show. And that over the course of the 90s, balloon and balloon and balloon. And then you had Joan Rivers doing her coverage for E, and it just like got bigger and bigger. And now it's basically its own show that is as long and as big as the Oscars itself.
Indeed. Tell me a little bit about writing your Two Harveys chapter, because if it took over 4 years, that things must have been changing. And yet, he sounds like an aggressive son of a bitch the entire time. So.
Yeah, I've been working on this book so long that I actually first wrote the book proposal before the Me Too movement, like before the scandal, but he was still in it. Like, okay, this is Harvey Weinstein. You can't tell the story of the Academy Awards without talking about Harvey Weinstein in the 90s and how he revolutionized Oscar campaigning in this way that's what he used to be infamous for.
Yeah.
As the guy who would like bully everyone into giving him Oscars. That was the old story about Harvey. Then the Me Too scandal happened and I immediately thought, oh gosh, like how do I do that? Like, I don't want to just tell the same old story about Harvey now that there's a much more important one. And I realized that in a way they were two sides of the same coin, in that Harvey used his prowess, his perceived prowess at the Oscar game to sort of as a shield. So that people would be in awe or fear of him. And in the shadows, he could be a serial rapist. And there was a moment in like 2002 or so when people really thought he was out. Like he suddenly sputtered, and there was this really damning New Yorker profile of him by Ken Auletta, all about how everyone just hated him and he was this browbeating asshole. But still, people were not reporting on what his behavior toward women and his crimes. And he bounced back through the Oscars. That was the year that Chicago won Best Picture. And he was basically giving quotes to the press, like, everyone 6 months ago thought I was out, but I'm back. And like, then he was back. And it took another 20 years or whatever or 15 years to actually expose him.
Yeah. And I constantly think of, I think I was really just starting to get into watching the Oscars when Gwyneth wore her pink dress and the revelations from her alone are very upsetting.
Yeah.
I love that the final chapter, I imagine like you were already going into production or close to it. And then the slap happens.
Oh my gosh.
Michael, how do you deal with that?
Okay, so here's what happened. This was amazing. So I turned in the book to my editor at HarperCollins, Gail Winston, last February. But I was really like, I sort of wrote the epilogue, the afterword very quickly at the end, and sort of like was trying to draw some grand conclusions. And like, I wasn't really happy with it, to be honest. I was like, I'm going to come back to this in the revision and I don't know, I'll have to figure out something. And then I go to the Oscars to cover them for The New Yorker. And I was there for the slap. Like, I was in the balcony and I ended the night at the Vanity Fair party. And right before I left at like 12:30 a.m., I decided to take one last look at the dance floor. And I go to the dance floor. I feel some presence behind me and spin around. And there's Will Smith dancing with his Oscar. Like, and the DJ turns on Getting Jiggy With It. And I just, a million phones go up and start recording as this man who has just like had a breakdown on live TV and assaulted someone and sort of like it just written himself this very weird new chapter in Oscar history, was just dancing to his own song with a gigantic smile on his face, holding this Oscar like he was, like nothing had happened. And it was such this dark, surreal, just completely weird image. And I was immediately like, oh, well, this is how I end the book. I mean, thank you. Thank you, Will Smith, for giving me this like bizarre ending. So I actually just on my next revision, I just rewrote the ending. And fortunately, I had time to do that because I kind of had to include this left. I actually subtitled the afterword Getting Jiggy With It, just so that people knew, you know, when you read the table of contents, you'll get there.
For sure. And I imagine that last February you thought perhaps like the last big scandal would have been The Envelope.
Yeah. I mean, the last big chapter of the book is called The Envelope, and it's about that envelope mix up with Moonlight and La La Land. I mean, when the slap happened, people kept telling me, oh, you're going to have to add a chapter to your book. And I was like, no, I'm already 14 months late. This thing is done. It's so late. It's done. But I did like write in a sort of my account of that night being at the slap and kind of got it in there at the end.
I love it. Before I ask you for book recommendations, I'm wondering if you have any predictions for this year's Oscars, not in terms of who will win and who will lose, but like, what will we see at the show?
Huh. Well, you know, there's a new leadership at the Academy, and I think they're really trying to not annoy their own members as much as the last few years have. So like last year, there was this whole hubbub over like shifting the sort of some of the smaller, so-called smaller categories to a pre-show and not having it live on the show. And that got everyone up in arms. And the new CEO and president of the Academy have said they're going to restore them. So I think it's maybe going to be a sort of more traditional crowd-pleasing Oscars. I mean, I don't know. Everyone is constantly talking about how to fix the ceremony, and because the ratings have been on a slide, and I'm like, just do what you want to do. Just make it good. Like, I feel like the problem is kind of bigger than the Oscars. Like, it's hard to get the whole country to watch a single show on TV anymore. And, you know, the movies are not as central in our, no one's going to movies anymore unless it's like Avatar or Marvel or something. So there's some bigger structural problems that are troubling the Oscars lately. And I think the answer is not to keep futzing with the ceremony or try to like make it cool. Like it always feels like it's your math teacher trying to rap or something.
Yeah.
About long division. I'm just like, make it great, make it a fun show. So I'm hoping they do that. And I think their spirit is in the right place now.
That's great. I can't wait to see. Michael, Oscar Wars, what a book. Before we go, can you please recommend some books for us?
Yes, I have something old and something new.
Perfect.
So for this book, I read just a ton of books from throughout the history of Hollywood. And the one that just will always have a place in my heart is The Lonely Life by Betty Davis. It was her memoir from 1962. And it is just incredible. First of all, Betty Davis is always in a fight with someone. So her telling her own life story is just one fight after another. And it's written in this like Betty Davis voice that is so incredible. Like the first line of The Lonely Life is, "I have always been driven by some distant music, a battle hymn, no doubt, for I have been at war from the beginning." It's like,
I love that.
It's okay. So great. And if anyone is sort of a lover of celebrity memoirs or old Hollywood books, just you got to read The Lonely Life. It's so much fun. And then something new is this book that just came out this month called All the Beauty in the World by Patrick Bringley. This is actually someone I used to work at in the events department at The New Yorker. And then I remained there. And Patrick left around 2008 or so. And his brother was dying of cancer and he wanted just a change in his life. And so he got a job as a security guard at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and spent 10 years there and has now written a book about his time as a security guard at the Met. And it is just a wonderful, it's just a gem of a book. It's about grief and art and just the particulars of this really weird, unique job of having to stand in a gallery for hours and hours and hours surrounded by the great masterpieces of the world.
Amazing. I can't wait to read that too. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you, Maris. It's been so much fun.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.